radioalbion.com.
Well, that's the round table. We dance where we're able. We do routines and corner scenes to footwork in bed cable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Hello and welcome to the Radio Albion Roundtable. Today's date is Monday, the 18th of April, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. As it's Easter, Monday, we have a Radio Albion special for you. The Roundtable meets once again with my friends and co-hosts, Grandpa Dan and Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Grandpa, how are you doing today?
You know, I was thinking you ought to pick some music for the roundtable, and it ought to be, remember that song, The Boys Are Back in Town? That's right. The gang is all back together here. Great to sit down for another roundtable. I'm always excited. It's always a good time.
Great band as well. I used to be really into Thin Lizzy. Matt, how are you doing today? Are you ready for the roundtable?
Well, you know, that's a really good idea. You know, I mean, the world is much better with Thin Lizzy music in it. And that's a great idea. I think that should be our bumper music. And it really it gets to the heart of the matter, so to speak.
And we'll leave the whiskey in the jarro till the end of the show. And today we're going to be talking about encouraging news stories. I thought let's have something lighthearted, something to encourage us. So we will have one news story each, which is hopefully going to inspire our listeners and encourage them and give them a happy sense about the world. And I'll begin with the one that I've got here. And I know we've mentioned him before, and that is just because it is always just so encouraging to hear what this man does. And that is Viktor Orban, who has won a two-thirds majority in Hungary for the third time in a row. And this is possible. If you have a good politician who does his best for his people, he's just going to get voted in time and time again, and he's going to do really well in the popularity states. And obviously he has done here. He's won an outright majority, two-thirds majority. So what does the press have to say about this? And the article that I've actually got here comes from Breitbart. They say, Hungary's National Conservative Prime Minister Viktor Orban has won a fourth consecutive term of office, matching Germany's Angela Merkel, despite the establishment left, the far left, and even the far right teaming up to oust him at the ballot box. In a victory speech to supporters of his Fidesz party on Sunday, Prime Minister Orban hailed their triumph over the overwhelming force of the left at home, the international left all around, the Brussels bureaucrats, the George Soros empire with all its money, the international mainstream media, and in the end, even the Ukrainian president, as proof that Christian democratic politics, conservative civic politics, and patriotic politics are not the past, but the present. So, I mean, he's going up against just about everybody that we go up against here at Radio Albion. He says, we have won a great victory, a victory so great that you can see it from the moon. Certainly from Brussels, the Hungarian quipped, in reference to the near uniform hostility to his government's anti-mass migration, socially conservative program amongst the European Union establishment. I think he refers to it as illiberal democracy, the opposite of liberal democracy. It's Christian democracy, basically. The international media seem to agree with the Europe editor for the BBC, Katja Adler, noting in her coverage of the election result that you could almost hear the collective thud of EU hearts sinking last night. Orban's reference to the Ukrainian president as a member of the coalition against him, which included even the Jobbik party, who were denounced as a neo-Nazi party by the president of the European Jewish Congress as recently as 2015, and once a source of great concern for anti-Orban news outlets, is an allusion to the fact that Volodymyr Zelensky intervened more or less directly in the election to accuse the Hungarian leader of openly supporting Mr. Putin. So he's even had Zelensky going against him as well as the EU, and yet the Hungarians have ignored all of that. They voted him again. References to Orban being a longtime ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin and famed for his warm relations with Vladimir Putin abound in mainstream media coverage, of the election results, even by notionally neutral outlets like the Associated Press and the BBC, although the Hungarian leader has always insisted that his dealings with the Kremlin have strictly practical bases, such as keeping gas prices down and the maintenance and expansion of nuclear energy production. So he has his priorities right. He wants to keep the prices down at the pumps so that the Hungarians are not spending all their money on fuel, having to spend three times as much on fuel as they were a couple of months ago. That's what it's like in Britain here at the moment. And I hear it's pretty similar over there in America. Uniquely among European Union member states bordering Ukraine, Orbán's Hungary has refused to allow weapon shipments to cross into the embattled country through its territory, although other forms of aid are permitted. So I mean, he's just thinking sensibly here. He doesn't want Hungary to be included as an enemy of Russia. I mean, Russia is, what is it, third biggest country in the world, third biggest in size. Why would you want to make an enemy out of your neighbours, especially if they're the ones that are providing all the oil and the gas to you? The Hungarian opposition had been pushing for weapons shipments to be allowed, but the government resisted, warning that this could see the country dragged into the war and moreover could see the Ukrainian region which borders Hungary subjected to more Russian strikes, endangering its substantial ethnic Hungarian minority. So there are also Hungarians there in Ukraine. I'm surprised Zelensky hasn't banned the Hungarian language as well and silenced anyone that's speaking up for them in the same way that he has done to all the Russians. Ukraine's treatment of its Hungarian minority has long been a source of tension between Kiev and Budapest, with the latter blocking cooperation with Ukraine in NATO and EU forums prior to the Russian invasion as a result. The Ukrainian government appeared to suggest that the Hungarian government desires that a victorious Russia will transfer sovereignty over the border region known as Transcarpathia to Budapest, a suggestion Orbán's government strenuously denies. So he has lots of good reasons, really, to not go against Russia. And the European Union's response to this has been to talk about sanctioning Hungary. They're now talking about removing the funds that are actually sent to Hungary from the EU. Basically, because they don't like the way that the Hungarians have voted. I mean, if you're in a democracy, it's supposed to be all about whoever it is gets the most votes, but apparently not. You have to vote in the way that the EU want you to vote, or vote in the way that NATO wants you to vote. Otherwise, you're going to get sanctioned. So this is wonderful news that Orbán has won again. He's also increased the birth rate over there. It's one of only a few white countries in the world that has a birth rate that is actually increasing. He's brought in all sorts of policies, tax relief for young families, help for, I think you get your house paid for after you've had three or four children. The whole mortgage is actually paid for, similar to some of the National Socialist policies that Germany had in the 30s and 40s to increase white birth rates. People criticize him for his support of Israel, but I mean, that's just really being practical, I think. Why would he want to make enemies out of Israel? He doesn't go in for the multiculturalism. He's kept Hungary with its Hungarian flavor, and his reward for that is that three quarters of the country has voted for him. And yet we're continually told by the mass media what a horrible person he is. I think he's just absolutely brilliant. And yeah, this really does stick it to the EU. And it's good to know that there is still some civic nationalist countries out there. I'd prefer to have ethno-nationalist countries, but just having civic nationalist countries in Europe like Hungary is great news. Matt, I know you know all sorts about this, about the intrigues there with Transcarpathia and the Hungarian minorities. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, that was actually the first thing that jumped out at me. We've had several shows on Orbán before. We're big fans of his, you know, 90% of what he does. Transcarpathia was a sort of semi it's their Carpatho Rusyns is what the ethnic group is called. Always been very, very pro-Russian. What makes them interesting is that they were under Hungarian colonial occupation for a very long time, and they were one of the harshest treated by the landlord class in Hungary. And so they've always looked to Russia for protection. They were artificially thrown into Ukraine, of course, during the Soviet era. And to think that Russian missiles are going to hit one of their most fanatically supportive places. Yeah, they're kind of like the Englishmen who live on the Falkland Islands. you know, you can't get more British than they are, because they're so, you know, they're far away. They're kind of cut off. That's their identity. And it's the same thing here. They're very Russian in their orientation. Throwing them in with Ukraine was a disaster. And then Ukraine declares independence, you know, in 91. So now you have this enclave of very pro-Russian with a smattering of the old Hungarian nobility living there. And so to think that Putin's ever going to give that up, that's a huge part of his base in that part of the world. Now, on the other hand, Hungary and Poland have a tendency to be anti-Russian historically. But that's changing, since we've also done shows on the Polish civic nationalists that win there over and over again, because this is very popular. Remember, when we were talking about the migration issue, and they were taking in Ukrainian refugees even in 2014 when the war erupted in the East. And they were condemned for not bringing in the third worlders, but they said, you know, we're bringing all these other refugees. And they actually explicitly said they're the wrong color. This is about third worldization. It has nothing to do with refugees. Now, of course, they're doing the same with however many Ukrainian refugees are going there. Part of the economic success of Hungary under Orban is that 75% of their oil is subsidized from Russia. Now, if you're going to go down the nationalist route, whatever label we give it, you're going to have to look to Russia for assistance. That's how the world has fallen now. You know, there's this blatant cold and almost a hot war of the globalized regime against nationalism wherever it shows up. Russia is the break on this. So if you're going to take this course, you have to look to Russia. So whatever animus they had centuries ago is disappearing. And to think, you know, they don't really have a place in the Brussels regime. They're fiercely independent, and they're economically very close to Russia. So the whole thing doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And they don't want to be dragged into this war. And Ukrainians and Hungarians have always been at each other's throats anyway, over Transcarpathia and everywhere else. So, the claim that somehow Russia had mistreated Ukraine is always answered by saying, oh, what about Ukraine and Transcarpathia? Because they really do hate each other. So they're not going to be given over. Russia is not going to attack them. But Johnson's law being what it is, you could pretty much – no one's even heard of this place. So you could say whatever you want. But the Transcarpathian culture is very interesting. It's like an enclave. And so they're certainly not going to attack it. And if anything, you know, they're gonna look to Hungary not so much to rule them, but as a support against the Ukrainian regime now that, you know, it's long since lost this war. So this man is a political success, he's a diplomatic success, and he is a huge economic success. And that's what embarrasses the EU. And they're not going to be a part of this war. And they've done everything they can to unseat him, but he's incredibly popular, even in Poland. A few years ago, there wasn't a single left-wing member of that parliament. So that's really the issue here. He's a holdout. Other politicians may notice this. Not only he's popular, but his policies have led to winning elections and economic success. You know, let them rage in Brussels. They are so drowning in debt and attacked by the third world. They have no position, no power to do anything. Hungary's market is to the east, not to the west. And they were a member of the Warsaw Pact for a while. So he's in a very good position right now, and this is why.
If democracy was genuinely about trying to get people to vote for you, all the other politicians would be doing exactly what Viktor Orban is doing. But instead, they're all ganging up against him. Grandpa, what are your thoughts on this stupendous win of Viktor Orban once again?
Well, I like that you brought up that he's, you know, some people have criticized him for, you know, being, say, friendly towards Israel and other. I've heard other assorted criticisms towards Orban. But, you know, I was sitting here thinking diversity is our strength. No, I was sitting here thinking that, you know, it really there is a diversity in nationalism itself. I jotted down here while you were talking. Nationalism comes in assorted flavors. And I think it's a really important thing for people to consider in the nationalist community around the world, that, you know, a Hungarian nationalism is not necessarily going to look like, say, a German nationalism or a French nationalism or a Chinese nationalism or whatever, because nationalism comes in assorted flavors, because you have these different groups of people, these different peoples living in different areas, and they all have different interests. Even among, you know, here in America, we're the worst for, you know, this blanket term white people, as if it's a universal term. But no, you have, you know, Hungarians are going to have a different mindset and a different point of view than, say, someone from France. So it's, I think it's important to always keep in mind that nationalism comes in different flavors. And if you look at somewhere, some place such as Hungary, and you look at Orban, you might not agree with everything he does. As you said, Sven, I mean, you know, being friendly towards Israel, it's a practical matter and it just makes sense. I think it's really funny to look at the things. The EU is so hostile towards Viktor Orban. And, you know, for what? Exactly. What is their reasoning, you know, when you get down past the empty rhetoric? Oh, well, let's see, because the rest of the European Union, the rest of Western Europe told their people that, well, because our populations are in decline, we've got to import the entirety of the Middle East and Africa. We've got to import the entirety of the third world. Matt referred to it as third worldization. That's their answer. They told people this was the only answer there is. There's no other answer. Well, Orban came in, and essentially put in some simple policies of, you know, tax incentives and financial incentives. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, the demographics have reversed. It was that simple. Now, some person might sit here and say, oh, yes, but look how much that costs. Really? How much is it costing in Germany? How much is it costing in these other countries to support these third worlders, which, remember when Merkel was telling them these people were going to come in and pay the pensions, remember that, which obviously was laughable on its face. Instead, they came in and got on the welfare. They came in and drained the health services, the national health care services and everything else. They were an overall drain. I would be willing to bet, I haven't seen the numbers, I'd be willing to bet the amount of money that Hungary has spent in incentivizing their own people to reproduce and increase the birth rate is a fraction of what these other countries are spending on welfare and other things to support these third worlders that have come into their country. I remember some time ago, right after he put these policies in place, 60 Minutes, I believe it was, did a hit piece on him and, you know, talking about what he was doing in his policy. And they literally said, they basically put like the sinister background music, but his policies have been accused of being racist because it's only for white Hungarians. Well, yeah, I mean, because he wants Hungary to remain Hungary. Which is, when you think about it, nationalism boiled down to a nutshell, isn't it? You can't claim to be nationalist and you just want to interchange your people for other peoples. And this applies to any country. You couldn't be a Nigerian nationalist if you stood up and said, we want to replace all Nigerians with, I don't know, people from Hungary. You know, well, you wouldn't be a Nigerian nationalist. Is nationalism in a nutshell when you want to, you know, support and encourage and work towards the betterment of your own people. Politicians have to be practical. They're going to make decisions you don't 100% agree with, but you have to look at the bigger picture and say, well, is what he is doing beneficial to his people? And I think obviously the answer is an overwhelming, well, yes. Yes, it is. And yet, what do we have? What do we have from the globalists? He names him here. George Soros, the EU, Zelensky. They all come pouring in here, pour all of this money in there, openly hostile, and try to thwart what he's doing. What exactly is he doing that is so bad that these globalist institutions want to stop him? Well, obviously, we understand what is so bad in their view. But still, as far as selling it to the people as a whole, this message that, oh, he's a really bad person, he needs to be stopped, that's why we're pouring all this money in opposition in, I think it's obviously a hard sell. And I think that's played out. I think that's reflected in these election results.
Yeah, that's a good point that you bring up there. It's Hungarian nationalism for Hungarians. I mean, white nationalists have tried to sort of encourage white nationalism over there. I think Richard Spencer's gone over there, Greg Johnson, Jared Taylor even, and they haven't really been welcomed. I think some of them have even been arrested. And he's just looking out for the Hungarians rather than wider Europeans. It is, as you say, it's nationalism boiled down to the origins of it. And what he does, does is he does what he thinks is in the best interest of the Hungarian people. And when the EU attacks him for that, he puts it to a referendum. Like recently, he brought in a law to prevent the promotion of homosexuality and gender ideology to children. Straight away, the EU said, this goes against EU human rights. We're not allowing this. And Orban said straight away, well, we'll have a referendum then. We'll ask the parents whether they think they should be the ones to give sex education to the children, or whether they think teachers should be teaching them gender ideology. And it was a resounding vote saying, no, we want the parents. It's up to the parents to make these decisions. It's not up to the schools if they want to start promoting this stuff to the children. And that's what he does. He did the same with multiculturalism. He did the same with immigration. He just puts it to the vote, and everybody votes in the sensible, normal way that you would expect. And it just leaves the EU wailing and gnashing their teeth. It's just wonderful to see. More power to him. We do like Viktor Orban here. Matt, we brought up Russia here and also what's going on over there in Ukraine, and I'm fairly certain that that is going to have something to do with the news story you wanted to bring to the table this week.
Yeah, well, you know, that might come as a shock to you that the Russian situation may come into something I say, but I'm going to go off on a limb and I'm going to talk about it. But this may seem like a strange, you know, you talked about how this has to be lighthearted. Well, I don't know how to be light. I couldn't be lighthearted if there was a pistol in my mouth. But India, we talk about nationalism. We talk about how different it expresses itself depending on size, circumstances, topography, economy, what kind of neighborhood they're in. And India's case, of course, their big chunk of their identity comes from fighting the British colonial regime there. And that means when you tell it what to do, especially if you're a Westerner, you tell it what to do, they tend to react. And that's no shock for someone who, you know, whose identity comes from, to a great extent, from the colonial experience. Now, given its size and relative economic success, where India goes as far as Russia and China are concerned is a big deal to Washington. Now, they've been fighting an on again, off again war with the Chinese in the Himalayan mountains. I don't know how you fight in the Himalayan mountains, but they have. And so relations there are strained, but the opposite is the case with Russia. The article I took from the Center for Research on Globalization is about this very kind of reaction, being told what to do. So the U.S. is threatening India with sanctions for, among other things, not rejecting the Russian position in global affairs, but also retooling its military. With just back in, it was in 2018, a $6 billion deal with the Russians for their S-400 missile defense system, which is the best in the world. Despite that, they are a member of QUAD, you know, U.S., Australia, and Japan, to oppose the Chinese at sea. So it used to be that, you know, that there's this Russia-China alliance against the world, but India doesn't see it that way. They view China one way, and they view Russia another way. So they're retooling their military. I mean, if you bring in a missile system from a country, you have to make sure that everything else in your military is compatible with it. So for those two reasons, so this is very good news. It's very good news because Russia has now this gigantic ally. And because they don't like being told what to do, they're going to react. And they're more dependent on the U.S. than they are trade relations than they are in Russia. But that's changing. The minute essentially, the Indians gave Washington the finger over this missile defense purchase, which they've been ordered to not do. Suddenly, within a couple of hours, you had Blinken in a joint news conference on a week ago talking about how awful India's human rights record is in Kashmir and in places like that. All of a sudden, there's this massive downpour of accusations against India. I've not heard a whole lot of the U.S. condemning Indian practices anywhere, unless, of course, they look to side with Russia. And that includes not just missile deals, but oil deals as well. It's strange, but India only gets maybe 5% of its oil from Russia, but that's also going to change. But something else tends to happen, and we saw this in the Philippines. When you side against the U.S., suddenly Islamic fundamentalism shows up, usually as ISIS or Al-Qaeda, in massive numbers. Al-Qaeda has now shown up again after we were told it was destroyed at one point. And I guarantee you ISIS is there. ISIS is being shipped there as we speak. Suddenly they've shown up and, you know, India has the world's third largest Islamic population. And for a long time, that war has become a Cold War over the, you know, the border of Pakistan and India. And suddenly now they're becoming radicalized right around the same time all of this is happening. Pakistan is being used as a transit point to ship some of these entities into Kashmir. And so now what they want to do is not only import violent Muslims, of course, trained by the U.S., but then condemn the Indians for fighting back. So essentially, they did a bait and switch here without realizing it. In joining Quad, the U.S. said, okay, we got India on our side. But India has this, even, you know, there was the center of the non-aligned movement during the Cold War. They're going to play both sides against each other as they see fit, which, by the way, is a perfectly legitimate nationalist point of view, especially in the third world. India hasn't quite broke that ceiling yet. They're still in the upper reaches of the third world, unlike China or Iran. So, you know, and the author says, this is just a few days ago, about a week ago, you know, it says they're talking about, you know, how the U.S. thought they had India under control, but then they say, but cracks in the relationship are beginning to appear as Washington is increasingly domineering and demanding, something that New Delhi will certainly not tolerate as it opposes neocolonialism given its own experience with the British Empire. And then they say accusing India of these human rights violations all of a sudden is a Pandora's box that the U.S. may not want to open given their own atrocities they have yet to be accounted for. Something that India has been mostly quiet about, but may no longer want to. Now, that's all the U.S. needs. You know, they have very few allies to begin with. But this level of arrogance, this belief that we just throw our weight around over there and this massive country is going to fall into line. I mean, who is working over at the State Department that actually believes this kind of nonsense? And then, as if that's not enough, this is a second article from the same place, roughly the same date. Because of the arrogance of the West over these things, India is pioneering what essentially amounts to a currency swap system, the ruble-rupee mechanism. And this way, they don't need dollars to trade with each other. Now, that has enraged the banking establishment. That's enraged Washington, because not only now are they militarily building an alliance, they're building an economic alliance. And this is one of the they already have one with China. Russia does. Now building one with India, it seems to be the shell of what the future world, you know, if nationalism really pulls this off, you know, thanks to Russia, this is what world trade is going to look like. You're not going to have these massive international bodies, these institutions like SWIFT, whatever, which is increasingly irrelevant anyway. But because they're not they're forbidden to trade in dollars with Russia. They said, okay, we're not going to use dollars then. Again, showing how out of touch the regime really is. They start believing their own BS after a while, thinking they're far more powerful than they are. And so not only is this developing with India, it's already developed with China. It's developing all over the place. And as I say here, this rupee-ruble trade mechanism will likely open an alternative channel for the global south, that's another word for the third world, to continue trading with Russia. It'll be possible because many Russian banks are already there. Of course, they're all over the world, private and state-owned banks. So this is now – this is what's replacing the globalist order. That's why this is amazing news. Most people wouldn't grab that from this, take that from this, but it's absolutely true. This is what the future world order is going to look like economically. Maintaining sovereignty and your own currency, having these currency swaps at an agreed upon interest rate, and hopefully, of course, interest rates staying more or less stable, which, you know, whether it be the gold standard or, you know, the ruble is now pegged to gold and oil. India is realizing that this is how it's going to be. COVID didn't help this either in interrupting supply lines and supply systems. Of course, economics claims of human rights abuse. These are all weapons of war, as are sanctions. And India, you know, this is what happens when you push and push and push. We've been warning, you know, the West this for a long time. You can't push these people. India is way too big. And then starting to condemn them because they didn't obey your will over one issue. This is what's going to happen. So you have the world's largest economy in China with this kind of system. Now you have the massive Indian economy with this kind of system. Everybody over in that part of the world where most of the market is going to notice this and build their own relationships. This is how a nationalist will trade internationally. Not using dollars, not using an international mechanism, but using these currency swaps that maintain sovereignty and currency with the same result. Now the dollar is increasingly irrelevant. And when that happens, you're going to have a massive crash. I don't think the average American is going to know because they don't seem to know anything, but a massive crash. The dollar is increasingly becoming irrelevant. Where the dollar becomes irrelevant, so does liberalism.
Well, Narendra Modi is a nationalist president as well, so he's clearly going to be doing the best that he can for India. And I think he's in this situation with Russia, and he's thought, well, we can get cheap oil. We're on good terms with Russia already. We have this weapon system from Russia. How is it in our benefit to start condemning them for a border skirmish with a former Soviet state? And the more that America tries to push them with this insulting language about the human rights abuses, I think the more they're going to dig their heels in. I mean, the only sort of worry I would see is with this border problem that they have themselves with China. And you're saying that you got Russia there, China, India, that's going to be like a new axis. What about India's relationship with China then? And also with Pakistan? I mean, if they're going to start attacking India and say, well, what about the human rights abuses there? What about the human rights abuses in Pakistan? I think surely they're probably worse than in India. And Pakistan has just had their president removed. I mean, how does that all fit in? I mean, there's quite a few different things there for you to pick apart, Matt. But do you want to bring any of those into the conversation here?
Well, you know, we've had a show on the Sino-Indian War. It's very low level. It's over a border mechanism, some trading roads in that very, very difficult part of the world, right in the Himalayas. But they do trade with one another. They have profited from one another. I mean, if the Shanghai Cooperation Organization can bring both India and Pakistan under its aegis, then really anything can happen. We talked about Hungary as a longtime enemy of Russia prior to the Cold War. Well, that's falling apart too. They're realizing that if we're going to promote these processes, we're going to have to join with them. And as far as the human rights record is concerned, that's a weapon. I guarantee you most of the stuff isn't even true. There's no, and I've read so many of these human rights reports. They're based on hearsay, ideological demands. Can you imagine internet freedom? The U.S. is condemning Indian limitations on internet freedom. If you can imagine the level of gall you have to have this for American to say that, especially in this administration. As this continues to develop, and as India is condemned over and over and over again, they're not going to have any choice but to make peace with China and continue to build these trading relationships. Pakistan tends to be a Chinese client, so that's going to be a problem. But given the pressures on India, and it's going to get worse, they're not going to have much of a choice. And I think the Indians are aware that the Al-Qaeda and ISIS and everything that the West is sending in is artificial. This is coming because the U.S. wants them to come, not because they're naturally there. All of a sudden, they're shooting again, which is not a coincidence. So these are the weapons that the U.S. has at its disposal, sending in ISIS, sending in Al-Qaeda, these condemnations, sanctions. They're all these devious, duplicitous mechanisms. But all that's going to do is inflame Indian opinion. The war isn't big enough with China to matter a whole lot, but they have been enemies on again, off again. There's peace there right now. But there's far more to be gained with cooperation than conflict as far as India and China are concerned.
So it basically exposes the machinations on America's side and how they manipulate these other countries and put pressure on them and try to leverage them into doing America's bidding. And basically, it's doing the opposite here. It's strengthening Russia, and it's strengthening India as well. Grandpa, what are your thoughts on Russia, India, China, Pakistan, and what's going on over there?
I don't understand how any of this can be a problem, because we've been told over and over again in the U.S. media that the entirety of the quote unquote international community has sided with the U.S. and the West against Russia. We've all seen the meme, you know, the map, what they mean by the international community. You know, India is not El Salvador. I mean, this is a very large country with a lot of people in it. And you see this instance here with the U.S. Once again, it's like, we do not have. Now, say what you want to about the way the U.S. government functions and has functioned in the past, but not that long ago, very much within my lifetime, we did have actual diplomats mad asked, you know, who is it at the State Department that's buying into this? And that really is something worthy of pointing out. We used to have actual diplomats that you know, did their job. We don't have diplomats anymore. It's like the only playbook the U.S. has is to go in and try to bully people. You know, instead of trying to work deals, they go in and try to bully people. And again, that might work for, you know, if you're talking about like, you know, El Salvador or a little small country in the Middle East or something like that. But you're talking about India. You've seen them try to take this more or less same approach towards China. And you know, it's like there's nobody competent running these things at all. Yes, India and China have this border dispute. They've had, like y'all have pointed out, on again, off again disagreements and have even fought each other and have even exchanged fire and whatnot. But here's the thing, I think, is like people in the U.S. tend to have this idea, like if you talk about two countries having an alliance on an issue, people in the U.S. tend to think that means like you're married to them forever, instead of the kind of more traditional notion that alliances are transitory. You ally when your interests are lined up, but on other things, you part ways. And I think that applies here. The India, from their point of view, they're looking at the U.S. running around acting like, I don't know, a belligerent drunk on the world stage. Yes, they're going to have their disagreements with China. Those aren't going to go away. But at the same time, I think if they're given the choice between work with Russia and China versus being bullied or being talked down to by the U.S., I think they're going to find a way to work where they're where their interests align. Yes, the border disputes they may have, that's not going to go away, but that doesn't mean that's a fly in the whole deal. It doesn't mean they're going to be absolutists and say, well, we're just not going to have anything to do with them now. We're not going to have anything to do with them because we have this dispute over the border. No, they're going to work with them where it's in their interest and then disagree with them on issues with this border. But it's not an absolute thing. But people here, especially in America, they tend to have this absolute idea like, oh, if you're a quote unquote ally of the U.S., that means you have to agree with us on every single thing. Now, y'all pointed out the dollar's in trouble, and everybody around the world pretty much knows this. The rupee ruble swap, this is a huge thing. You've got Saudi Arabia now talking about, well, we don't necessarily have to sell oil in dollars. And this gets zero play in the U.S. media. Wouldn't matter if it got play. People wouldn't understand it. But it is a huge, it's an absolute huge deal, because what is kept, we're already seeing inflation getting ridiculous here in this country. And people realize the reason they create all this money through debt, they're able to export it because of the dollar demand internationally. And what's the dollar backed up with? The full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And obviously that faith and credit is starting to crumble internationally. And as the dollar gets abandoned, there'll be no demand for it, which tells us that, you know, the value of it is going to go down. And you have this crowding out. I think we're going to see an increase of it, of the dollar being phased out of international trade. They're obviously upset with this. They're obviously, you know, not happy over it. And yet you have to scratch your head and say, well, you brought this on yourselves. Again, we have no diplomats. We have nobody like saying, like coming out with real ideas and policy and strategy. Their only thing they fall back on is bullying. They've gone around, they've done these sanctions and act like this is so smart. And every time they impose these sanctions, every time they kick somebody off of the banking system. Every time they do these things, they undermine that full faith and credit, and the demand for the dollar is eroded. Now you've got them making these deals, such as this rupee ruble swap, and they're upset about it, and they're all wound up. And it's like, well, who do you think is responsible for that? Y'all did this. You can't go around. You can't go around and use the economic system. If they had any sense, they would keep that off the table, because that undermines the U.S. But they don't have any sense. So they've done these sanctions. They seized people's property and said, we're just going to keep the money. They've seized Russian assets and said, we're just going to keep the money. They've done all of these things. And now the full faith and credit, people are starting to go, wow, we see where this is going. They go around and bully everybody. And if you say, no, we're not going to do that, they're going to take your money. They're going to take your assets. They're going to kick you off these systems. We better get off of these systems. It's common sense. And yet they're sitting around, they're upset about this, and nobody in the State Department, nobody in Washington seems to appreciate the fact that it is they themselves who've brought this about. This is 100% sitting in their own laps. It's they themselves who have done this.
You know, I think there's going to be a lot of unrest coming with the way that the prices are all increasing in the so-called international community. And yet in India and in China, they're taking advantage of all this cut price oil that Russia is offering. They're offering all these discounts to them. And to the West, they're saying, well, you need to have our oil, but you're going to have to pay us in rubles for this. I mean, it's just working out really, really great for Russia, China and India. And Europe and America have got these increase in fuel prices. We're going to see massive increases in food because of the fertilizer costs. And we're going to be looking over there at the raised standard of living in India and Russia and China and thinking just what's going on here with our governments. And we're being told, oh, we're sticking it to Putin every time we fill up the car and pay two times the price that we were paying last month. I do think that we could see some unrest on the horizon. Perhaps it's all planned and that ties in with the Great Reset, and that's what they want to see. But I don't see that they have control over India, China and Russia. I mean, they may have this Great Reset in the European Union and America, but we're just going to see an increased standard of living in these other countries, I think. And what's the American government up to? What are the American government doing, Grandpa? I believe your news story has to do with something encouraging that the American government have just succeeded in putting into place.
Yes, you have to have my mindset to read this story and see that it's it is actually encouraging. And this actually does. It seems like a complete random Grandpa Dan topic, but it is not. It actually ties in what we're talking about, because we were just talking about how the U.S. foreign policy now is devoid of diplomacy. And it basically involves in going around trying to bully people around the world stage. So today's story comes from RT, and it's titled Pentagon Outlines Equity Priorities. These are the priorities of the U.S. military while they're going around, you know, basically threatening everyone on the planet. The Pentagon has published a equity action plan detailing its progress in implementing President Joe Biden's very first executive order and outlining what the U.S. military intends to do next to embed the idea of equity in everything it does, ranging from embracing transgender soldiers to making sure making sure artificial intelligence isn't racist. The military is committed to having a holistic strategy of continuing to cultivate enduring and equitable change, said the document, dated April 13th, but made publicly available on Friday. The plan was mandated by Executive Order 13985, the first thing Biden signed after taking the oath of office in January 21st. As some of the examples of what the Pentagon has already done, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin pointed to the February 2021 stand down to warn all DOD personnel of extremist ideologies that will not be tolerated in the military, in reversing the Trump administration's prohibitions on the use of critical race theory and transgender Americans serving in the military. Current DOD policy provides a means by which transitioning service members may obtain gender-affirming medical treatment and recognition of their self-identified gender, and seeks to protect the privacy of all service members, the Pentagon noted in the report. These are luxury issues for these people to be focused on. I mean, really, this is not, I mean, you've got, we've got we had this senator come out and say that maybe we should put troops in Ukraine to oppose Russia. You got John Bolton, who's wandering around out there still advocating for every war on the face of the planet, saying we need to station U.S. military personnel in Taiwan and poke China at the same time. So not only should we be poking Russia, we should be poking China at the same time. And in this bullying attempt that they do, and what is the U.S. military focused on? Are they focused on, could we actually, we lost in Afghanistan, but we're really going to be able to take on essentially a two-front war with Russia and China. And what is the military focused on? They're focused on these things. And these are luxury issues. These are like, if there was total peace on the planet and the U.S. wasn't engaged in hostilities with anyone, this sort of thing would be harmless and silly because it'd just be a social engineering program using the military as like a test subject. But they're going around. You have to read this with the backdrop of them going around, basically causing trouble everywhere. Now, they use these proxy fighters, the ISIS, the Islamic terrorists everywhere they go. And yeah, I guess that works to a certain extent. But at some point in time, somebody's going to call your bluff. You know, I was reading an article just the other day, and China was once again warning, you know, the U.S. against encouraging this secessionist thought in Taiwan. And it always amazes me because you can tell when you read these stories that people at the State Department, because they don't mean anything they say, they assume that people in these other countries don't mean what they say. China was basically saying, you know, we will come in and basically blow everybody up and make our point if we need to do that. We don't want to do that, but we will do that. Now, this is right after Russia basically calling their bluff in Ukraine, working diplomatically for years to try to resolve their security concerns. And they just assumed, oh, well, they don't mean it. They're just bluffing. Oh, obviously, they were. And now you see the same mindset with China and Taiwan. Oh, but they don't mean it. They wouldn't really do that. Now, where are they doing with the military? They're running around worrying about stuff like this. These are the things. There's this complete disconnect. There are no professionals. They know there are no professionals in charge. It's really an amazing thing. I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to Matt and then Sven, and then we'll come back and do this. This gives me an opportunity, by the way, to drink coffee and listen to y'all's well-educated opinion. Matt, how are you feeling about the being able to pay for transitioning surgery in the U.S. military?
Well, as we all know, the only thing that can happen is that the military is going to be stronger. It's going to be more unified. It's going to be more focused on its sense of purpose. Now, I understand why this is good news. It's good news because the U.S. military's sole purpose today is to impose and defend liberalism all over the world, especially in places that don't want it. That's its purpose. And you can't have a meritocracy in the military or a very white military can do that. Military, with the exception of the Air Force, has been a bastion of some variation of conservatism, at least in the Vietnam era and shortly afterwards. You can't have a vaguely conservative military imposing liberal policies abroad. So, you know, people without military experience, I mean, I come from a military family, I don't have any myself, you know, it kind of does make sense from their point of view. But of course, we all know it's going to fall to pieces. This has been a issue of mine actually for some time. And people who know my Patreon account are going to see that I have about five or six papers on this. Back in 2014, the Air Force purged its ranks of conservatives of any sort. The worst thing that you can do is politicize the military, because people are not being promoted based on ability. They're being promoted based on ideological affinity and race, gender background. I've seen the Air Force seminars, which they do in conjunction with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League is very close to the Air Force Academy itself, and they work together all the time. And here in 2012, they created the Workplace and Gender Relations Survey of active duty members. They spelled gender G-E-N-E-D-E-R. That's what's happening here. So at least since 2014, they've been not only purging high-level officers who don't go along with the program, but they're actually even basing promotion on adherence to this stuff, which means, you know, the upper reaches of the armed forces are in chaos, have been in chaos since Obama, if not before. Now it's even worse. No one even knows who to obey anymore, or if even obedience, other than to leftism, is a virtue. I want to quote something from the ADL, and it says, this is on military.com. It says, last year, this is 2011, the Academy and its partners, including the Anti-Defamation League, developed three additional lessons that will be taught at other times. A one-hour seminar during sophomore and junior years, two-hour lesson during senior year, teaching cadets to become allies to other cadets when they witness respect infractions. We're giving them avenues to address those issues, and we emphasize addressing those issues at the lowest level. These issues, of course, are homosexuality, race, gender, transsexualism, and all that. And I'm going through, I mean, this is on their website. The ADL is in the academy, and you should be reading this. I mean, they're the misspellings. These are semi-literate people. And we also remember the Air Force Intermediate School of Professional Military Education at the Air Command and Staff College, where they openly condemn ethnic nationalism. Ethnic nationalism is the pressure that comes from presuming that our own group is the best, the right one, the chosen one, and all other groups are, well, not as good. So the Air Force has declared war on anything that's connected with patriotism, nationalism, traditionalism of any kind. So it's now totally politicized, which means it's not going to function well. Respect is going to disappear. And the traditional pool of applicants is going to dry up. No one wants to fight even the Green Berets. So I have a whole section on the Green Berets, where their high standards are now gone. And the general that commands it is talking like he might as well be Jesse Jackson. Now, the Navy and the Army have their own program, but the Air Force has always been the most extreme. The Marine Corps is going to be a tough nut to crack, but they're cracking it as we speak. So from their point of view, I mean, these are people, and we've said it before, they start believing their own nonsense. They truly believe this is going to make the Air Force a stronger, more cohesive unit by pushing this and having it all funded and lecturing to white students at the academy, having ADL people right there in the academy lecturing to them. They honestly believe that. But this is also why these guys are not a threat to anybody. Because in China and Russia, you have the exact opposite mentality. They don't have the high rates of pay that officers have here. They don't have the luxuries. And to think that this was Joe Biden, or, you know, in quotes, that was his first executive order. The very first thing he did in the executive order department is this. That's how high a priority it is. And, you know, this is why, as Grandpa said, they're going to have to use, you know, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever, because this is not a threat to anybody. If this is their number one priority, and the defense secretary already said that, this is the number one priority. The head of the Marine Corps said this is the number one priority. Nothing else. This is the main thing. It's going to create chaos, and the U.S. military is going to end up performing worse and worse and worse over time. It's bad enough that it's lost every war it's ever been a part of since World War II. But now it's going to get even more fractured. And this is good for us. That's why this is such a good news article. But to the left, they really actually believe this is going to help things.
That's quite incredible, isn't it? You know, you got Russia that's unveiling hypersonic missiles. You got North Korea that have just tested a new missile with nuclear carrying capacity. And then you got the American military, and their number one priority is embracing transgender soldiers and making sure artificial intelligence isn't racist. I mean, it doesn't even sound like a military, is it? And then what they say they're doing at the end here is they're giving out free treatment for transgenders. So they're basically offering free castration for their soldiers. And they think this is going to make them into the world's top military. I mean, it is literally doing the worst that you could possibly do to a soldier, is to castrate him. But that's what they're doing. They're providing a means by which transitioning service members may obtain gender-affirming medical treatment. So literally, castration is at top of the list for Joe Biden here. And as we know, in China, they're very concerned about just all the hormone disruptors that are in the environment. And they're not allowing South Korean K-pop stars that are too effeminate to appear on the television, and they're trying to encourage their young boys to be more masculine. And yet what we have here in America with the most masculine of the masculine, the military and the top military guys, and they're being encouraged to get castrated. I mean, it's just laughable, isn't it? Grandpa, please do continue.
Yeah, if they were doing that to prisoners of war, it'd be considered a war crime. But as long as you're doing it to your own dudes, I guess it's okay. Back to the article. As for future goals, the plan envisions a 5-point strategy to embed equity into everything the military does, starting an ambitious equitable procurement and contracting agenda that would reorganize the entire supply chain and give more opportunities for small disadvantaged businesses and traditionally underserved entrepreneurs to get Pentagon contracts. The second goal relates to improving the lot of underserved communities living near U.S. military installations, mainly Native Americans, but also residents of Guam, and having to deal with unexploded ordnance and consequences of old nuclear tests and other issues that come with the territory. Military families belonging to underserved communities will also get a hand to address food insecurity, job prospects, and education through the lens of culturally responsive teaching strategies. The DoD aims to expand investments in minority-serving institutions and historically black colleges and universities. It's, one of the things I think people make a big mistake on is you'll see people here in the U.S. and they'll point to the U.S. military. Matt's already said, militarily speaking, they're really not a threat. That's why they're using these proxy groups. But I'll see people say, like, no, we've got the most powerful military on the face of the planet, buddy. And they'll point to expenditures. And they make this mistake of thinking, well, we spend umpteen times more on our military than anyone else. That must equal our military is more powerful. But the amount of corruption, these military contracts, I laughed at this part where they're talking about, we're going to make sure these military contracts are going to go to these smaller contractors. And we all know that's not true. I mean, it's just like when the White House came out recently and said, the Democrats and Joe Biden are working on legislation to tax billionaires like 20% of their wealth. I'm old enough to be that gets promised all the time. And it never actually happens. Nobody in their right mind believes they're really going to do that. It's like telling your boss, I'm going to punish you. I'm going to write your boss. You're my boss, but I'm going to write you up. It's just silly. They work for these people. This idea that they're going to funnel money now to these small contractors is just laughable on its face. It's basically a money laundering operation. You've got these things, these projects, and they go way over budget, and they spend billions and billions, even trillions of dollars on failed projects. The laundry list of laughable failed U.S. military contractor projects is quite lengthy. And yet you have Russia and China, that basically anything, any manufacturing that's related to their military is not for profit. They're basically nationalized. And what do we have as a result? Well, they have hypersonic missiles and we don't. We sail these giant – I always laugh because we sail these giant carrier groups around the world and always say, yes, if the U.S. military – when people point to that and they're like, well, look at our Navy. Nobody else has carrier groups like America has. Yes, if World War II breaks out, if the Japanese get uppity and bomb Pearl Harbor again, we're ready this time. That is basically where the usefulness of this stops. We spend all of this money. All of this money, and it all gets funneled into the right pockets. The corruption is rampant. You see these generals and they push for these projects. Then they retire and they go to work for Raytheon or they go to work for Lockheed Martin. Everybody has seen this over and over again. But yet people think because the U.S. military spends all of this money, it must mean that, we have the most powerful military on the face of the planet. Meanwhile, in this very article, they have to point out that military families have issues like food insecurity. We spend trillions of dollars on our military. And yet military families are worried about things like food insecurity. Now, you have to know that, when you have something, a big organization and like the military, the level of competency, the more you phase out, the more diversity you get, the less competent it is. You can get a certain amount of that. And I don't mean to be mean here, but the fewer, basically, as long there's a breaking point where when you don't have enough white people and Asians that are actually making sure things function, when you break over that point, things quit functioning and they just start not working anymore. You can see that with the post office. You can see that in other government agencies. There's a breaking point that once you phase out enough of the people that can actually get the job done, then everything quits working. And we see that. I really believe there's a lot of evidence of that in the U.S. military. They can't, you know, they can't sail these ships without crashing into cargo ships. We had the ship burn up in the port. I believe it was in San Diego, and they did the investigation. And it turned out that nobody on the bridge of the ship, understood that you're supposed to push the button that puts the fire out, because they have a fire suppression system. And nobody understood on the ship that, well, you're supposed to push the big red button. Nobody understood what it did. They didn't understand how the fire suppression system even worked. And yet, with the backdrop of this, we're going to go around and bully everybody on the face of the planet. Matt, I'll go ahead and kick it back off to you again.
I'm glad you mentioned the Navy. I don't know if you remember, but it was a few months ago, I did an entire Orthodox Nationalist on the condition of the Navy. And, you know, that, I mean, the training standards have collapsed. Standards, period, have collapsed. But I also, I'm happy that you brought up the money issue. Because, you know, the official budget is roughly $750 billion. That does not take into consideration any social spending, which is what we're talking about here. The massive retirement fund, veterans affairs, international affairs. It doesn't take any of the off-budget stuff into account. It's deliberately misleading. The only thing the defense budget deals with is on-budget weapons and deployment costs, period. It doesn't include payments to mercenaries. And we're talking about this lack of standards. Think of the failures that these people have been a part of. Just the last 10 years, the RAH attack helicopter, massive failure. The polar orbiting satellite system, the expeditionary fighting vehicle, the XM 2001 Crusader howitzer, and the non-line of sight cannon. All of these cost tens of billions, are all failures and never came to production. And when you include interest, you know, it looks like, you know, maybe $1.1 trillion is really the Center for Defense Information says the national security budget, which is different from the defense budget, is well over $1 trillion. And as I've said many times before, it was, I want to say 2013, the Ernst & Young from New York was hired to audit the Pentagon budget. And they couldn't. This is due to the total lack of controls. There's no accountability. This is one area that's not very disciplined. There's no firm policies keeping track of inventory, the value of assets, construction, just to name three. The logistics agency, which is really the budget outlay people, had such bad record keeping that the auditors gave up. In other words, no one has any clue how much the Pentagon really spends or what it has. I've read that 37-page report from Ernst & Young saying that the military doesn't even remotely maintain even basic standards of accounting. The Fed has never been audited. That's true, but neither has the Pentagon. There's a law. It's called the Audit the Pentagon Act, which is pretty self-explanatory. They have refused. That was actually 2017. They've refused. Not even a piece of the Pentagon's budget can be audited properly. And because of the worship, and you know, I've been railed against the worship of the military over the years, this is why they get away with it. They think they're invincible. They think that they are the top of the heap. And I go into in detail about, you know, the enlisted men are treated like grunts. Officers, once you get past captain, are so wildly overpaid that they're really almost like the top 5% of earners. And the Air Force is worst of all because these signing bonuses now are in six figures. And it depends on where you're deployed. But this is where, and no one has any clue where this money comes from or where it's going. And so you add what we've been talking about here, you add that to the mix. Stuff like you mentioned about the guy not knowing how to press the button, which is a day-to-day occurrence, that's going to get worse and worse and worse as standards fall. You're bringing in people with lower IQs. You're focusing on social spending and these ideological issues. What do you think is going to happen? The Navy's in a disaster. You know, about a third to a half of naval aviation can't fly. Lack of pilots and spare parts and mechanics. The Air Force is about, you know, roughly the same. These are all on paper. And I do. I tell you, Grandpa, I'm going to steal the line that, yeah, if World War II breaks out, we're going to be ready. I'll give you a footnote, though. Don't worry about it. But that's a good line, and that's exactly correct. And that gets to the heart of the matter here.
Well, I think navies are obsolete now anyway, now that there are hypersonic missiles. But you're talking about the budget there and this huge budget. And I think that's really what's at the heart of this. I think these minority groups have looked at the budget and thought, we fancy a slice of that. And that's why it says they're going to expand investments in minority-serving institutions and historically black colleges and universities. So they're going to invest the money into these black colleges and these black universities, and they're going to encourage education through the lens of culturally responsive teaching strategies. And the end result of all of that is, as you say, they don't understand that you've got to press that red button in an emergency. And all of it is, instead of based around encouraging the best out of people and a meritocracy, it's just all based around doing things for the people that aren't really that good at doing things. And rather than encouraging them to get better, it's just saying, well, we'll help you out with your food insecurity. We'll change the teaching so that it's more culturally responsive, rather than actually teaching them what they need to do, rather than actually raising the standards and having high tests, high physical tests and high mental tests. They're just lowering everything. I mean, even the physical tests now, they've had to lower them so that they can allow women to take part in everything, because otherwise it's sexist against women. I mean, they'll be reducing everything down to the standards so that the disabled will be able to take part soon, eventually, because it's discriminating against the disabled. They've lost the whole reason for having a military and what a military is for, which is to defeat your enemies. And none of this is about defeating the enemies. All of this is about is lowering everything to the lowest common denominator and weakening your military, particularly with this free castration idea. But yeah, Grandpa, do please continue.
Well, I'm glad you pointed it out that this means weakening the military, which the military is supposed to be focused on their enemies. And this is why I picked this kind of as an encouraging thing, because it has become more and more apparent that the U.S. government views the people of the United States as their own enemies. So I really wasn't even being sarcastic picking this story out as an encouraging story. The rest of this little article gets into artificial intelligence. One particularly notable goal is to conduct artificial intelligence research with equity in mind, to avoid cases where AI face recognition algorithms have difficulty recognizing darker-skinned individuals, or maybe learning and magnifying the biases of human screeners. AI can help the DoD map innovative new pathways towards greater equity in hiring, promotion, retention, and workforce management, the report said, while well-designed and continuously tested systems will also ensure that we must use the tools of lethality, that we do so in keeping with our national values. Biden's very first executive order, enacted on January 20th, 2021, ordered the U.S. government to focus on advancing racial equity and support for underserved communities, while previously U.S. laws and government policies focused on equality of opportunities for all citizens. The current White House has focused on equity, defined as equality of outcomes. Now, I was sitting here thinking when I was going over this, when I picked this, and I'm thinking, what is the purpose? When you know the basic function of what a military is supposed to do, so they bring up, basically lethal action, which is, the military's job is to kill your dudes and blow stuff up. So what is going to be, you have to assume that developing artificial intelligence in the context of a military capacity is going to have to do with killing people and destroying things. And I thought it was funny that they were talking about touting their policy on AI, and they want to be sure that the AI can recognize and identify dark-skinned individuals. If I was a dark-skinned individual, I would be sitting here going, now, wait a minute, you're saying you're doing this for my benefit, but it's being done in the context of killing people and blowing stuff up, and you want to make sure it can identify me from these other people. And of course, the rest of what we had just read here is really just a bunch of rhetorical gibberish. It's more back to our values, our democracy, and who we are. These things that don't actually mean anything. And at the end of the day, this doesn't equate to a stronger military. It doesn't equate to the U.S. is going to be able to really, we can go ahead and pick a war with Russia and China. I said at the beginning of reading this that, in the context, when you look at this in the context, and we can kind of laugh at it because it does seem absurd, but we have sitting U.S. senators saying we need to put troops in direct conflict with Russia, and you have people like John Bolton saying, and we need to go ahead and station a U.S. military presence of 20,000 people or something on Taiwan so that China just knows that, you know, we're the boss in town. And you read a story like this, and it's absolutely disconnected. It's absolutely disconnected from reality. These people, it's like there's nobody competent in charge any longer. I'll go ahead and hand it to you, Matt, and then Sven can take us on out of here.
You know, the same thing happened in Britain the 2nd of February. RT ran a story on the same thing. They had a six-hour – all training was halted, and they had a six-hour period of reflection, they called it, on culture and inclusivity, to think differently and to bring training to a complete stop and alter it. Sir Mark Carlton Smith, general, said, it's not about us being woke. It's the army addressing some of its unacceptable behaviors. Some of those behaviors are, of course, thinking as a nationalist, as a conservative, of one type or another. That's obviously and clearly the target here. Now, veterans, you just look at the comments on these articles. Veterans are mocking this relentlessly. But given the fact that the purpose of the military is what Grandpa mentioned, everyone knows that. But that's not how these people see the military. Remember, in Somalia, in Iraq, Afghanistan, the point was to rebuild the society. It's almost a form of revolution. You destroy it. You destroy the family, and then you rebuild it according to what they want, which means private sector corporations are going to make billions out of it. It's no different than a revolution in the normal sense of the term. It's to take and all these countries have been very conservative, and when it comes to, you know, women and sexuality and media and everything else, that's the point. You know, protect Israel, but also to revolutionize the way they think. And nothing revolutionizes than war. It breaks all traditional arrangements. That was the point of it. So these are nation-building entities. It's liberalism carrying a gun more than the normal sense of a military. And I think that's precisely, you know, redefining what the military is a common title for a lot of these white papers in public and the private sector. That's the point. Now it's a way to rebuild the planet according to liberal corporate ethics or lack of ethics, and to do it violently, to imitate a revolution, destroy everything and then rebuild it. That's the point of it. And of course, it's failed everywhere, thank God. And I remember when one of the smaller military bases in Afghanistan raids the rainbow flag, and there's pictures still floating around of that, you know, what do you think the Taliban did? You know, this is what they want to impose on you. And, you know, it's one of the many reasons why the operation fell. But they were raising the flag in full view of the locals in the area. So they only care about these communities so long as they don't fight back. But the minute they do, the military tends to cut and run. And this is why.
Well, I think the Russians do see the rainbow flag as the flag of the New World Order and the flag of NATO. But I have to come back to what you were saying here, Grandpa, about the AI face recognition that has difficulty recognizing darker skinned individuals. And they really have complained about this, and they've said that this is not on. The AI doesn't recognize black faces, and it's quite obvious because they're darker and you need the light in order to see the definition. And what it's actually resulted in is that black criminals don't get caught out by the AI. So in actual fact, if they do end up fixing this, they're just going to end up with the same problem that they have now with the discrepancy between the numbers of black criminals and the numbers of white criminals. And that when they say here that their well-designed and continuously testing systems that will also ensure that when we must use the tools of lethality, that we do so in keeping with our national values. I'm guessing what they mean there is that they won't kill more black folks than white folks, because this is all about equity. It's not about equality, about treating people equally. It's about equity, so that it always has the same outcome. So I guess what they mean there is if they're drone bombing people in Pakistan, they'll also have to find some white people that they'll also have to drone bomb, so that it's the same numbers. I mean, it is just absolutely ludicrous where they've ended up. And I really don't think that the American military is going to really last that much longer. I think we've had this debacle of what happened in Afghanistan. And I think what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment could very well be the final act in the US military and the New World Order. Well, I certainly hope so anyway. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much for coming on today, Grandpa. I do hope you will join us again for another Radio Albion Roundtable later on in the year. And thank you very much, listeners, for listening. And we do hope you enjoy the rest of your Easter Monday. And we'll see you all again next time.
We're knights of the Round Table. We dance when we're able. We do routines, to call a scene, to footwork.